Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello once again, and it's great that you could join the program today. Recently I read an article on the website sakcentral.com called The Joy of Giving by Lau Rahal. Rahal opens with a quote from The Art of Living by Eric Fromm. Giving is more joyous than receiving, not because it's a deprivation, but because in the act of giving lies the expression of my aliveness. Rahal explains it in this way. The more we give, the more we experience the world as the creation of our efforts and as a reflection of our aliveness. In the well-being of individuals that we support, we experience our aliveness. In the growth of communities to which we are genuinely dedicated, we experience our aliveness. The entity that we care for, whether it's a community, a fellow human being, or any living or non-living form, is the source of our empowerment. In it, we see our power. Through it, we feel alive. For experimental psychologists, a cause and effect relationship, no matter how plausible and beautiful it sounds, cannot be accepted unless it is confirmed by means of experimentation. He then describes an experiment we've spoke about earlier in this series of programs when quoting an article by Dr. Emma Sapala on compassion. It was some time ago, and you may well not remember, so I'm going to leave Rahal to describe the experiment again in his own words. He says, to test whether giving contributes to our well-being and whether giving is more joyous than receiving, Elizabeth Dunn and colleagues conducted an experiment at the University of British Columbia, Canada. They randomly selected a group of undergraduate students and gave them either $5 or $20. Participants' level of happiness was measured. Then half of the participants were asked to use the money they received to get something for themselves. The other half were asked to use the money to get something for someone else. Participants' level of happiness was measured later after they'd spent the money. The group who spent the money on someone else reported a higher increase in their levels of happiness than the group who spent the money on themselves. Dunn and colleague Michael Norton conducted similar experiments in different contexts and in different parts of the world. They consistently found that giving increases happiness more than receiving. Their results were summarized in their book, Happy Money, The Science of Happy Spending. Rahal goes on to say, spending money on others is not the only way of giving. The practice of caring also has been found to increase levels of well-being and decrease symptoms of depression. For example, in an experiment in Northern Ireland homes for the elderly, residents who were given a canary to take care of had decreased symptoms of depression. Those who were not taking care of a pet did not. He then makes the fascinating point that while we have a survival instinct, which would seem to put us in competition with others, we also have an altruistic instinct, which makes us find joy in helping others and in contributing to their survival and flourishing. Now, these two instincts might appear at odds, but in fact they are complementary. Rahal writes, the altruistic instinct actually emerged from the survival instinct. Our ancestors hunted in groups, built shelters in groups, and escaped predators in groups. Collaboration was their main strength, and in order to collaborate, they had to help one another. He then quotes S.G. Post, an author of a 2005 article titled Altruism, Happiness, and Health, It's Good to Be Good, from the International Journal of Behavioral Medicine. Post, he says, argued that the drive for help gave our ancestors an advantage. Altruistic behavior within groups confers a competitive advantage against other groups. In groups where individuals enjoy helping each other, collaboration is more likely to develop. Consequently, the group is likely to function better. Altruism is in the genes we have inherited from our collaborative ancestors. In World War II, only 15% of riflemen fired at their enemies during combat. According to psychologist Dacha Keltner in 2009, Often soldiers refuse to fire at the enemy with superior officers barking commands nearby and bullets zipping past their heads. Keltner argued that the altruistic instinct kept soldiers from firing. Killing fellow human beings is against our nature. In order to stop the altruistic instinct from interfering with the soldier's behavior, the army changed its training. Infantry training exercises played down the notion that shooting kills humans. Soldiers were taught to shoot at non-human targets, trees, hills, bushes. The effects were dramatic. 90% of soldiers in the Vietnam War fired at their enemies. The target had to be dehumanized for the soldiers to shoot at it. Rahal continues, when we do kind things, we feel happier. When we hear about others' kind deeds, we also feel happier. Keltner noted that once we hear stories of altruistic and kind acts, we immediately feel goosebumps and we sometimes find ourselves in tears. He argued that we are wired to be inspired by hearing the good acts of others. He continues, in a memorable altruistic act that has inspired millions across the globe, Jacqueline Nyetepe Kiblimo, a marathoner who was close to a win in Zengai's International Marathon, noticed that a fellow runner was suffering from dehydration. She decided to assist him and run by his side until he reached the finish line. This act of selflessness ultimately cost her the race, but her second place finish will never replace the first place finish she has in her heart after watching what she did. This inspiring act of kindness and the reactions of admiration that it provoked illustrates a basic truth about human nature. We are wired to care, and we are wired to admire those who care. And don't you find that quite inspiring? Sometimes it really seems that we are wired not to care, or rather to care only for ourselves and our own interests. We only have to look at what's happening in the crazy presidential election race going on at the moment in the United States. But let's conduct an experiment on ourselves. I'm going to read a couple of stories on generosity from www.bsgp.org, a website seemingly dedicated to gurus of non-Buddhist traditions. But Buddhism has no proprietary claims to our theme of generosity, so I don't see why we shouldn't borrow inspiration from the whole range of spiritual traditions. Let's see how these two stories affect us, whether we do get goosebumps or not. The first is a story from the life of Swami Ramteeth, a saint of the Vedanta tradition who used to wander around the whole day preaching kindness and love for God. He used to cook dinner for himself. One evening, he came home very tired after a long tour and preaching session and started cooking his dinner. Just then, a group of kids came to see him. Swamiji served all his dinner to the children. One onlooker was amazed and asked him, Swamiji, you've given away all your dinner. Now what will you have? A bright smile crossed Swami Ramteeth's lips as he replied, the purpose of dinner is to satiate hunger. It doesn't matter whose stomach it has gone into, it has served its purpose. But to me, the joy of giving is million times the joy of receiving. That's one story. And now the other story is similar. It's from the life of the great Indian poet Magh, who was also famous for his generosity. The website reads, his financial condition was not very sound, yet that made no difference to his generous attitude. One late night, a poor man came to seek his help and said, I have to arrange my daughter's marriage ceremony, but I'm penniless. I've heard about your kindness. Would it be possible for you to help me, sir? Poet Marg's heart was filled with compassion. He looked around his house. There was nothing to offer. Suddenly he saw the golden bracelets in the hands of his wife, who was asleep. Very slowly, he took one of the bracelets from his wife's hand and said, I do not have much to offer. Please accept this gift. Just then, his wife opened her eyes and said with a smile, how can a marriage ceremony be arranged with a single bracelet? And she took off the other bracelet and gave it too. Marg and his wife were filled with a divine joy that cannot be described in words. Now, how did these two stories strike you? One of the things I really like about them is their simplicity, open-heartedness in the most mundane activities of life. We don't have to make grand gestures, donate large amounts of money to good causes, or preach heady sermons to great audiences. Our attitude in everyday activities may be more of an indication of where we really are at than what we say or do in crowded public spaces. This is similar to the Buddhist teachings that say a bodhisattva merely hearing someone asking for something experiences bliss beyond or any happiness that an ordinary person can know. Imagine the bliss that then comes from actually fulfilling the deeds of the one asking. In our striving to become enlightened, isn't this what we're also aiming for? To be able to give anything and everything without even the slightest hesitation or hint of miserliness. I think this is what Nam Kha Pel is pointing to in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, as he teaches us how to give away our body, possessions, and even our virtues. But now, before we continue, let's focus on motivation for coming together today for this program. Of course, our motivation should, if possible, be bodhicitta. We are participating in the program to attain enlightenment to benefit in the best ways possible all beings everywhere. Can you have that motivation? If you can, it'll be wonderful. But if it's too great, at least think that you want to be liberated from all suffering, and that is why you're here today. Anything less is not really all that worthwhile, for it will not lead out of this samsaric existence. Thank you. Now, returning to Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, we're going through the process of familiarizing ourselves with bodhicitta, which depends in turn on developing great love and compassion. Great love and compassion are distinguished from our more mundane understanding of love and compassion by their object. Usually, our love and compassion are focused primarily and strongly only on those close to us. But great love and compassion focus equally strongly instead on all living beings. This means that instead of only having love and compassion for our relatives and friends, we develop our capacity to love for and empathize with all beings equally. To develop such love, the text instructs us to train in giving up everything. As we said before, our possessions, our body, and even all our virtues. We hold nothing at all back, which for most of us is not so easy to do. That's why we are encouraged to first of all visualize giving everything away, turning our bodies, possessions, and virtues in our mind into everything that other suffering beings require, and then giving it to them. That is what we've been learning over the last few programs. Deepak Chopra explains that the benefits of generosity go way beyond the happiness we may feel when we give. In a 2009 article, also on the joy of giving, on the Huffington Post website, he writes this. Giving, taking, earning, stealing, squandering, hoarding. These are all human impulses, and we wouldn't be human without them. Yet on this list, only one item, giving, appears in the world's wisdom traditions. Why is giving set apart? After all, there's no mystery to why someone might want to earn, hoard, squander, or steal $1 million. One way or another, most of our daily actions follow the principle of more is better, whereas giving means having less. Do the great spiritual teachers want us to have less? Have they figured out, instead, a higher way to give that will add increase to our lives? Now, if you ask people why they give, the readiest answers offer clues to the mystery. God wants me to. I feel better about myself. Others need and I have. I want to share. It's only right. A hazy halo encircles these good-hearted answers, and if we bring it into focus, the following seems true. Giving takes you out of yourself. You expand beyond your limitations. The inspiration behind Charity Focus, a brainchild of Nipam Mehta, declares that it's impossible to create a better world without inner change that results from selfless service. He then goes on, I have recently joined as a contributor to the Start Fund, an organization founded by Dutch philanthropist Fred Matzer. This is a very innovative way to mobilize funding for worthy projects without the conventional tedium of fundraising. Others might argue that inner change precedes selfless service, But no matter. Selfless means that you've been taken to a place outside yourself. In the Indian tradition, that happens to be impossible because all of reality is centered in the self. But they don't mean the self that is involved in tit for tat, this for that, getting and spending. Your true self is an expanded state, and you can only reach it through experience. When giving results in an experience of love, joy, peace, community, charity, caring, and self-worth, the process of expansion has begun. Some visionaries foresee an economy based entirely on giving. Now that would be an ideal way to heal the excesses of unfettered capitalism and many other woes. But the basis for universal giving can only be expansion beyond our present sense of self. Merely turning the tables, expecting to be rewarded for how lavishly you give, won't work. Expansion of the self brings a direct experience of love, joy, and the other things I mentioned. You get a glimpse of ecstasy, the state of standing outside yourself in the infinite field of being. Stand there, and all the money in the world wouldn't buy a ticket back. You would wish to be there forever. Which is why Jesus offered those pungent words about storing up riches in heaven rather than treasure on earth. Deepak Chopra goes on, the mystery of giving is revealed only when you crave the ecstasy that has been glimpsed. Then a realization hits you with full force. I must give myself away. Without realizing it, you have been trying to do that all your life. In giving away yourself, you open a conduit for the kind of happiness that no one can ever steal from you. Someone once said that permanent joy results when you can give away your last penny. Actually, the penny is only a symbol. Permanent happiness results when you no longer have a personal stake in the world. When you see through the constant needs of I, me, and mine, no more needs will remain. There is only being. And then every breath is bliss giving itself to bliss. That's the rhythm of life, and I'm sure you felt it. It came over you the last time you truly gave yourself away. You joined reality once more. You entered the space where holiness resides. Namkar Pal explains this entering into the space where holiness resides in terms of vastly increased merit. He says that, practicing generosity sincerely towards all sentient beings, we can instantly accumulate merits as innumerable as the beings themselves. When we practice sincere generosity towards one being, it is said that we accumulate a lot of merit. So you can imagine that if the object for the motivation of our actions is all sentient beings, that one being motivation is multiplied infinite times because they are infinite sentient beings. Namkar Pal illustrates this with a quote from Nagarjuna's Precious Garland. If the merits of speaking thus could be given physical form, it would completely fill the whole of space. This was stated by the subduer Buddha and supported by sound reasons. For just as the number of beings is beyond limit, so is the intention to benefit them. It is not so hard then to see how important it is to cultivate generosity as much as possible. Not least is the fact that this is the basis for great love, which in turn is the basis for bodhicitta. However, we have to be careful, for Namkar Pal tells us that once we have dedicated our possessions and so on to others, we cannot take them back or even forget about those we've made dedications for. He writes, when we use the food, clothes, and so on that we have sincerely dedicated to other beings, if we forget the welfare of others and use them with attachment to ourselves, it is a deluded downfall. If it is done free from such attachment, but forgetful of others' interests, it is an undiluted downfall. If you have dedicated a certain thing to someone else who knows it and has taken possession of that thing, and then, motivated by self-interest and an intention to steal, you make use of that thing, this qualifies as stealing and is a breach of the vows of individual emancipation, as the compendium of training makes clear. We should examine how a bodhisattva should behave when he makes use of such things. If we make use of something with the intention of working for sentient beings, there will be no moral fault. The compendium of training says, there will be no fault if you think, I shall use these with the intention of protecting both the possessions and their owner. This is similar to the case of a slave who, always in the service of his master, has no belongings of his own. Just as a note, the vows of individual emancipation are things like the five precepts, the various vows of ordained people, and so on. So, if in our minds we give everything we have to others, including, as we've said before, our body, possessions, and virtues, then we can't use them as if they belong to us anymore. Whatever we have should be used with the intention to fulfill the needs of others, even if it appears we're using it only for our own benefit. This should, of course, make us careful of how we use anything. Let's say we want to eat an apple. If we bite into it for nothing more than our own enjoyment, it is regarded as a moral downfall. It is better to think something like, by eating this apple, I will sustain myself to be of greatest benefit to others. This is a fairly mundane and simple example, and apart from Sleeping Beauty, it's doubtful anybody could be that attached to an apple. But what happens with something much more valuable? Like, say, a Mercedes-Benz convertible you have legitimately bought with your own hard-earned wages and are crazy for. How do you stop the intense clinging to this car as yours and yours alone? How do we always use it with the intention of benefiting others? It will become more easy if we can regard nothing as actually belonging to us, for nothing actually does it? Everything we have is actually on loan to us, for sooner or later we must part from it, no matter how attached we are. If it were really ours, it could never belong to someone else, because by its very nature and definition, it would be ours only. In due course, you will be separated from the Mercedes-Benz, no matter how much you are in love with it. So it's only yours to use for a limited period of time before it becomes someone else's. You only have a guardianship of it for a short while. Realizing this helps us to relax a bit about owning belongings. If we can regard ourselves as stewards of the things that we could come under our control, so as to speak, there would be much less of a tendency to clutch on for dear life. We can be more detached, so that when the thing inevitably goes as it must, there's no need to get upset. It was inevitable, and the time has now come. Another point to ponder is that things are only ours because of convention. Going back to the Mercedes-Benz, how do you know that it's yours? Only because everyone, well, maybe not everyone, but the vast majority of people made a pact with you. We will let you keep and use whatever you swap for a piece of or two of paper. Yes, we grasp at the bits of paper that come floating out of the Reserve Bank as if they were the most valuable things on earth, while in reality, they only have value because we have given it to them. In themselves, those bits of paper are only that, bits of paper with some gobbledygook printed on them. But going back to the Mercedes, if everybody but you said it's not your Mercedes, would you still own it? Sooner or later, someone will come along and perhaps self-righteously take it from you, and then nothing you could do would legitimately make it yours. We own things through convention. That is, we've invented a system of barter involving the representative of value we call money, and agreed among ourselves that whoever buys something will be able to keep and use it as long as he or she wishes. This is just a conventional agreement between ourselves. We could have agreed that nobody owns anything at all, and all property is communal. Then it would be impossible to say the Mercedes was yours and to act in any way as though it was. Ownership is a matter of agreement. We don't even own our own bodies. If we did, would we allow them to become sick, old, and die? Here is a reflection on the website Buddha Space that makes this point quite well. One thing that you come to realize in Buddhist meditation practice is that nothing you previously took to be you is in fact you. By this, I mean to say that both body and mind do things that we don't want them to do. They age, get sick, and die, no matter how much we protest or wish otherwise. How often has the body been unwell or tired when we really wanted it to be at its best? And how many times has the mind not been able to focus on the task at hand, distracted by regrets, fears, and the like? Let's face it, neither body nor mind really belongs to us. They belong to nature. They are natural phenomena going their own way, doing things that we'd rather they didn't. Aging, being ill, and then dying. This understanding of the true nature of our self forms the heart of the Buddha's teaching. It's what makes his message so profoundly different from the other spiritual greats. He first taught on the impersonal nature of existence in his second sermon, called the Anattalakkhana Sutta, which he gave to the five ascetics that had become his first ordained disciples. Anattalakkhana is usually translated as the characteristic of not-self. All five monks realized complete enlightenment for themselves after hearing this teaching of the Awakened One. He taught, form monks is not self. If monks' form were self, then form would not lead to affliction, and one might be able to say in regard to form, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. But since monks' form is not self, form therefore leads to affliction, and one is not able to say in regard to form, let my form be thus, or let my form not be thus. Basically, the Buddha said that since we have no ultimate control over whether our bodies are sick or not, young or old, alive or dead, they are not truly us, nor do they belong to us. These bodies will get ill, age and die according to their nature, irrespective of what we think. The Buddha also applied this principle of not-self to our feelings, positive, negative, and neutral, to our perceptions, mental formations such as thoughts, and to our consciousness itself. None of them constitute a permanent self, and nor do they belong to a me that I take to be here. They belong to nature. This is the radically unique teaching of the Awakened One that had not been taught before him by any other religious figure. Indeed, it has not been taught by any major non-Buddhist religious leader since, either. Usually, religions involve the concept of an internal self or soul, whereas the Buddha cleverly avoided the attachments that can grow towards such concepts, thus causing a revolution in the spiritual history of humanity. The repercussions for the understanding of what we are still being felt over 2,500 years later, not only within the Buddhist traditions, but increasingly among scientists too. If the Buddha's teachings is so, what do we really own and what can we really clutch onto as ours? Nothing. We're only here for a short time as guardians of our body, possessions, and even our virtue. All belongs to others. And that is our contemplation for the next week. Now time is up and we must say farewell. Please dedicate as usual for the enlightenment of all sentient beings. I hope you'll tune in again next week. Thank you and goodbye.